Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is February 20th, 2015. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, graphic artist, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. Since February is the month we're usually thinking a lot about love and relationships, we decided we would go to the ACIM text for some inspiration and wisdom on the topic of love. So if you want to pull out your books, we will be looking at Chapter 16, Section 4, The Illusion and the Reality of Love. Well, let's get started, everybody. It looks like people are coming into the chat room, and Bruce, we are ready to take off. So good morning, Bruce.
Welcome, CA, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you for coming today. I mean, this is such an exciting chapter, and I want to thank you right off the bat for just really bringing it back to my attention. This is a great section of the text, and it meant a lot to me to be able to re-review it. So thank you for suggesting this.
Oh, thank you. And re-reviewing it is always a good thing because there's so much in that. And I think that's why A Course in Miracles emphasizes relationships, because that's where we play out ego strategy by default and undo it when we go past the default and look for our inner kindness teacher's alternative interpretation of things. And I think that's when we really get the help that we all want, when we, you know, get ourselves out of the way. and look at the relationships that we have that really are really distilled down to just two. We have a relationship with the ego by default as separate people, and the inner kindness teacher, or Holy Spirit as the Course calls it, or Jesus as it's referred to, that symbol is really the representative of what we took with us into the dream that leads us out of our quagmire of thinking that there's something out in the world that we need to fix.
So where would you like to start in this chapter? You want to just start in the beginning?
Let's do that. The first sentence right out of the chute is awesome. Be not afraid to look upon the special hate relationship, for freedom lies in looking at it. And there we have it. If we're willing to look at the annoyances from the most minor, I like to think of it, the range of hangnails to Holocaust, to the most major, anything that we find irritating or upsetting or in any way compromising our peace of mind is a perfect example. And it doesn't have to be the classic, romantic, interpersonal relationship. It can be a relationship with things or the weather or technology or, fill in the blanks. But certainly our interpersonal relationships tend to be the most problematic, just because we've invested so much in making big deals out of them and making them really the mechanisms by which we reinforce the ego, which means that becomes our classroom for undoing the ego when we are willing to look at it. So,
right. And the truth is, when we have irritation about anything, any kind of frustration, then in a sense, we have a special relationship with it.
Exactly.
Right? If there's an emotional response, if there's emotional reaction, we have a special relationship. And the Course often refers to those as either hate relationships or love relationships. And, one thing I'd like to introduce here, too, because if you're new to the Course, if this is something that, like, you're jumping into Chapter 16 and you haven't read the rest of the text, or you haven't been at it very long, I think 16 actually incorporates or has a lot of ideas that we kind of skip right over because we go, oh, that doesn't apply to me, or, oh, I can't see how that works. I mean, in other words, I think it's hard, especially in the beginning, to even start identifying that these are special relationships, to understand what that means, and just denying that we even have special hate relationships.
Exactly.
So I want to encourage people, really pay attention and just try to open up to these ideas, because these, to me, really are the ones that I was most willing to just go, I don't think so. I don't think so. What is it talking about?
Well, we certainly have tremendous resistance to the whole idea to begin with, because it really is really undoing everything we've made up. But fortunately, we get a curriculum in A Course in Miracles that takes us gently and gradually through that process. So we get to look at the things that upset us a little at a time. And I know you've had Doug Sparks on your program, and and previously, and one of the things that he reminds is that we don't have to do the most difficult things first. To in response to your comment about people are just starting to study the course and practice it, we can practice on little things and then build up to the things that are in our minds more big deals. And mm-hmm. but just looking at the idea that we don't really have neutral thoughts. One of the early workbook lessons that ties into this, I think, very nicely, is that there isn't anything neutral. But we can start by looking at the things that are maybe just minor annoyances, and recognize that we have special relationships, as the course calls them. In other words, we make specifics into big deals, and we choose to be upset by outcomes that happen in our space-time dream drama. And so the special hate relationship, as the course would describe it, is really just taking the things that are those annoyances and looking at them and seeing that there's nothing to them. We've made them up, and I think that we can do that in retrospect oftentimes by looking back at things that used to be big deals, mm-hmm. and then saying, oh, gee, the things that used to be horribly challenging to me as a child or an adolescent or a young adult or whatever phase of our experience we might be looking at, those in retrospect can often seem minor or even trivial, and I think that's the perspective that the course is asking us to develop over time, to slowly generalize, but gradually look at more and more of the contents of our mind and see that none of it really has the power to take our peace away. If we can shift our identity from the person on the screen, the dream royalty, the the drama royalty,
yes.
drama king and queen, and as the case may be, and shift our identity to the spectator in the audience who's watching it, the dream maker, the dreamer, if you will, of the dream. And when we do that, then we can look at those relationships, whether it seems to be one of love or hate, and see that anything that has to do with a transient or temporary aspect is basically an ego trick.
Right.
it's just a shenanigan that the ego is trying to keep us in a sense or a state of ill ease or lack of peace. So we need to look at both of those, and I think looking at special love and special hate is a way to do that. So maybe we just read on. The rest of this paragraph, I think, is equally brilliant. So should we just?
Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So it goes on and says, it would be impossible not to know the meaning of love except for this. For the special love relationship, in which the meaning of love is hidden, is undertaken solely to offset the hate, but not to let it go. Your salvation will rise clearly before your open eyes as you look on this. So seeing the ego's strategy of trying to make certain people or certain circumstances or jobs, houses, cars, health regimens, fill in the blanks. In anything that we do in the world, which of course would use the word, the adjective magical.
Yes, it uses magic.
meaning the magic is really trying to take something that seems to be outside of us to affect a change in our mind. We're putting the whole metaphysics backwards. We're basically saying that something that's an effect can become a cause, when really the only cause that we have available to us as a choice is to choose which of the two thought systems we're going to participate in, whether it's love or fear, to really be simplistic about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what it really boils down to. And the love that A Course in Miracles talks about has nothing to do with anything that can change. So that immediately redefines how that oft abused word gets used in our culture, because we have so many references in our society and in our everyday use of that word to things that come and go, and yet I think the essence of any spiritual teaching of any worth its salt is that if something is true, it can't change. And so anything that really would be worthy of calling love that is is lasting is something that can't be dependent on any particular circumstance, including or any particular individual, including the self that we think we are.
Right. And you know, I want to say something about just the way you worded that. And it does come from this particular chapter, but that idea of true love, because what we want to do and what we so often do is we get together with somebody and this is my one true love. Right. And then when it doesn't work out, when that one true love doesn't meet all our needs and somewhere along the line it falls apart, we go, oh, well, that wasn't true love. Now I want to go find my soulmate. That just wasn't my soulmate. And so then we launch again to try to find this true love. And often if that one implodes as well, then once again, we each time keep going, oh, well, that wasn't true love. And I want to say that on one level, you're absolutely right. That wasn't real love. But on the other hand, I think we keep trying to think that we're going to find true love, that real love in this person. And this is what this chapter is telling us, that as long as you believe there's an opposite, as long as you believe hate is out there and you're not willing to look at that, then in a sense, all you're doing is looking, you know, fruitlessly for these different partners that are somehow going to be this special love to you. And it's always going to be a disappointment until we stop and look at how we're using it. You know, that in a sense, we're using love to somehow protect us from the bad things in the world, you know, to kind of draw a line in the sand and say, okay, now I can keep out hate. I can keep out disappointment. I can keep out all these things as long as I have this one person or this group of people with me.
Right, right. Yeah. And what the phrase that comes to mind as you're saying this, that a very simple but potent four words is seek not outside yourself.
Yes.
And but we do that in countless ways. And we go from one thing to another, one relationship to another, whatever it is. Anything in the world that we think is going to make us happy is a setup. I think it's a brilliant setup. But as Ken Wapnick says, it may be foolproof, but it's not God-proof. And because the spiritual being that we are, as all as one being, is aware that this is a setup, and that is really what we turn to when we turn to what I like to call our inner kindness teacher, and look at the special love and the special hate, and look at the things that we've made important and attached and appendage our identity to. That's, I think, a critical thing, because it doesn't mean that we don't do things for the people in our lives that we care about, and we we suddenly become less kind. If anything, looking at these things, it will help us to be more kind, because we're not attached to the feedback or outcomes as a result of what we do. So.
Right. I mean, that's it. We're not making that person responsible for our peace of mind. We're not making that person responsible for our happiness.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. You know, and yet, like I said, I think these are some of the most difficult concepts to get, not only intellectually, but to get them right there in our experience.
Absolutely. If we were to look at our mind's portfolio, using the investment metaphor, it's like we're up to the ears invested in those kind of relationships, because we think it's sort of a Machiavellian ego strategy that as long as we can set ourselves up for disappointment. And of course, that's the last thing we'd ever want to admit. As long as we can set ourselves up for disappointment, we'll keep this game going. And that's the ego's strategy. It's ploy. It's thinking, oh, well, as long as I, shift from one thing, one person, one strategy to the next, as long as it involves something, quote unquote, outside myself, then I know that someone will disappoint me. And then the classic line, behold me, brother, at your hand I die, kind of thing. Because then we can justify victimhood. And then erroneously, we can think that somehow that strategy of projecting our unconscious guilt is going to work for us. And that, we can maintain our relative innocence compared to someone outside of ourselves. And it doesn't matter who it is or what it is, as long as there's someone or something that is the scapegoat. then we're safe, we think.
Right. And in fact, in terms of safety, I think it's the second paragraph of this section. It says, the special love relationship is an attempt to limit the destructive effects of hate by finding a haven in the storm of guilt. But it makes no attempt to rise above the storm into the sunlight. I mean, what a great kind of just picture there that, yeah, we're trying to find this safe haven in the storm, but we're not really looking for the light.
Right.
We're not looking for that at all. And later in the paragraph, it says, and the special love partner is acceptable as long as he serves the purpose.
Right. You know, as long as the idol hasn't fallen.
Right.
You know, but once the idol topples and we realize, and then the end of that third paragraph, the last word is disillusionment. You know, so if the illusion goes, the relationship is broken or becomes unsatisfying on the grounds of disillusionment. Well, actually, because a long time ago I realized, well, disillusionment, that actually can be a really positive thing seen from the right perspective. Because if we're letting go of illusions, we're disillusioning ourselves. Of course, that's the ego's, you know, woe is me cry. But to what we really are, that actually is a very helpful place, as long as we keep going beyond the nothing that the ego offers and continue onward to the everything that our inner knowingness holds out to us eternally, just waiting for us to accept it. Because what we really are as one essence, one unseparated being, has everything. And that's the quality that we all think we've thrown away. We think we somehow shattered perfect oneness, but it's just been patiently waiting there with this sort of little, you know, Cheshire grin, waiting for us to remember that nothing has happened to disturb this perfect peace that we have as our birthright. And then it goes on, love is not an illusion, it is a fact. Where disillusionment is possible, there was not love but hate. So really, the fake love, the special love, as of course refers to it, is really just a form of hate. But that's, again, one of the last things that the ego wants to admit, because it doesn't want to, you know, have the game over sign flash across the arcade in our mind.
Right, right.
we want to keep playing the game. So, but if we're really serious, and that's not even necessarily the right word, but if we get to the point where we've been there, done that, enough with the ego shenanigans, and say, gee, all these specialnesses that I've tried to make me happy aren't working, and I'm ready to try something else. At that point, then we can look at those things, and I think, again, to reiterate what we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, is we get to do it on a slow, gradual basis. We don't have to jump in and look at everything in our lives all at once. We can just look moment to moment at what's going on, and see that when we try to make what's outside of us fulfill us, we realize it's just a desolate wasteland of disappointing scenarios that don't offer us anything. Skipping across to the next page, middle of paragraph 8 in this section, it says, the special love relationship is but a shabby substitute for what makes you whole in truth, not an illusion. Your relationship with them is without guilt, and this enables you to look on all your brothers with gratitude, because your creations were created in union with them. So, any kind of whether it's romantic love or whether it's an attachment to a pet or a family member or a job or a place on the map that we think is holy or sacred, or, you know, any kind of idolatry that we can, you know, shake a stick at, and it doesn't have to be a very big stick.
Yeah.
You know, it just anything that however subtle or blatant comes across our mind is, oh, I'm making a big deal out of this. That's when the ego strategy is to recoil in terror. And because it doesn't want us to look at that desolation and that devastation of the nothingness that it was trying in desperation to keep alive. But as long as that illusion of hatred is there, you know, then the real love that is behind it is going to be, you know, out of our awareness. So,
yeah. And it reminds me somewhere in here too, I'm not sure exactly which paragraph, but it talks about trading one illusion for another.
Yes.
And see, that's what we do too. It's like, if you don't know that you're dreaming, if you're not willing to ever stop and look at the real cause, if you're only looking at the effects, then in essence, what we're doing is we're trading, just like we trade one partner for another, or we trade one job for another, we're trading one illusion for another. And we don't recognize that we didn't move away from the anger, the frustration, the disappointment. We just traded the illusion, and it's just going to come right back again. Right. Because one illusion is like another illusion. Although some of them are more fun than others.
Well, it's certainly a convincing illusion that they are, isn't it?
Yes.
But we've done all the convincing. You know, our minds are brilliant and powerful, and we've made up a world in which it seems like, you know, some people get all the luck and have all the fun and yada yada yada, and then there's you know, and then there's those who appear to have just horrific lifetimes, and yet, seen from the perspective, a cosmic, I like to call it astronaut's perspective sometimes, if we can compress time and space to the nothing that they really are, and again, that goes against everything that our whole sensory and persona mindset is geared toward. But if we can look at that objectively and see what we've made up as having differences and separate identities and you know, preferences, positive or negative, as being made up, then really the only choice, as you point out brilliantly there, that really there's no choice among illusions. In fact, in that the fifth paragraph, it says, and then the only choice remaining possible is which illusion you prefer. There is no conflict in the choice between truth and illusion.
Mm-hmm.
So seen in those terms, no one would hesitate, but conflict enters the instant the choice seems to be one between illusions. But this choice does not matter. Where one choice is as dangerous as the other, decision must be one of despair. So really, you know, it's kind of like whenever we choose illusion A over illusion B, which really has anything to do with space or time or anything temporary or finite, we're basically saying, I'm going to choose this disappointing alternative relative to this, I think, more disappointing alternative.
Right.
But it's still disappointment, you know?
Right.
A rose is a rose is a rose, and a skunk is a skunk is a skunk, you know?
Well, and in the next paragraph is one of my very, very favorite sayings from the Course in general. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. You know, just what a great line.
Yeah.
I love that. And we so often forget it because, once again, we're so busy projecting outside and looking for somebody to make us feel good that we don't recognize all the ways that we are shielding ourselves from the light, from the love. You know, we've got all the armor on, so to speak, and then we're blaming other people for not getting through.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And that's another irony, is that in truth, if we allow everything in our classroom to become a forgiveness lesson, if we can look at everything that happens to us, and again, this is something we can, you know, build up to gradually, but if over time, with the goal being to be able to look at anything that happens in our lives and say, oh, this is feedback from some part of me that wanted me to learn that this is yet another example of something I don't have to put my peace in jeopardy around or because of. And that awareness, I think, is something that is really what we're all looking for, is the love, the tranquility that really transcends any words we could use to describe it, is there waiting for us. You know, the barriers that we've built against it are the specific examples that we've brought into our life on almost all the time, an unconscious level, but they're there as our classroom to help us using the undo principle of forgiveness by forgiving the dreamer, forgiving the seemingly individual self that is really, you know, it's really a you know, it's what we are, and the dreamer is that's being addressed in A Course in Miracles is really the mind that's outside the space-time realm. So what we're really looking at is this self that knows on some incredibly deep level that everything that's happening to us or appears to happen to us is really coming from us. And because it's coming from us, there's no one outside of us that really is, warrants our blame and our projection of anger and so forth. And if that collapse of space then brings it back inside, and then we can look at, you know, time the same way. There's really nothing outside of us temporally. If we collapse the space-time thing, and then we recognize that the dream that we're having is what we call our life, and our waking dreams are every bit as much surreal as our nighttime dreams, then we can say, oh, if this isn't what I really am, then what appears to be ephemeral, what seems to come and go, can't possibly be what I really am and what we all really are as one being. So as a result, that gives us the basis for true forgiveness, as the Course would describe it, because true forgiveness basically says that you know, what we think has happened has not occurred. And so we don't make stuff up and then try to undo it. We basically recognize that the whole entire basis for all of our issues, all of our big deals, is unfounded.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, it's a dream. You know, it's a theatrical production in our mind that we've made up. And from that perspective, then of course it makes sense to forgive everyone. And then that frees us up to be kind, not only to ourselves, but to everyone that our life touches.
Right. Well, and I love when you were talking about, you used the word, and it just seems so neutral and so gentle, when you said feedback. Oh, here's more feedback.
Uh-huh.
You know, if we could only look at everything and instead of going, oh, well, why did he say that to me? Or why did this happen? You know, I love saying why. And I'm slowly learning that why is a useless question. I am, but especially between you and Susan, you know, it's like, why is a useless question? But just that idea of, oh, here's more feedback. What can I do with this? Here's more feedback. And let that be a very neutral thing of, yeah, open my eyes to this feedback so that I can really move in the direction I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Feedback sort of implies a scientific objectivity, which I think
yes.
is encouraged in the Course to just look at it. And in fact, you know, in various places it says, you know, you don't have to agree with it or even like, you know, what the workbook yeah. exercise is, but just try it. Just try it. You know, as an independent, objective, scientific mind, you know, just
try it.
See if it works. How else would you know if it works if you don't try it?
I know. I'm fond of going back to that introduction in the workbook because of that, because that just blew me away when I first read it. Because when do you read a book that literally says, okay, you're probably not going to believe this, you're not going to like it, but you don't have to, just do it. You know,
exactly,
I was like,
exactly.
Oh, they're being pretty right up front there, aren't they?
Of course, that could sort of relate to maybe early parental memories that may or may not have worked as effectively. Yeah. When our folks, as a youngster, might have said, "Well, try this," and well, maybe that didn't work out quite so well, but maybe it did. Who knows?
Yeah,
anyway, that's an aside. But the beauty of this curriculum is that if we really do practice, it really does work. But the ego strategy is to say, "Well, gee, how come, you know, how come I don't have you know, a fleet of yachts?" You know, the abundance off the chart and you know, stunningly immortal health. And, you know, because the ego wants to make it all about the form.
Right.
But the our inner kindness teacher aka Holy Spirit, says it's not about anything specific, but yet we get to use the specifics. And I think that's where the special love, special hates are like the poster children of our specifics classroom, to say, oh, if I can look at these things that bug me about a particular person, or annoy me about myself, or you know, whatever, and use those as a means of undoing an identity that hasn't served us, then we're on a totally different track, on a totally different curriculum from the ego's default.
Yeah, and what you just said, though, is really important. And in fact, I had this conversation with a friend just the other day, and that is, we look at our lives and if we go, well, I'm not abundant, or I'm sick, or this is going on, or that is going on. And what this person said to me is something equivalent to, I must not be very good at the course, or, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't remember the exact words, but I'm not a good course student or something. And I'm just like, no, you know, I mean, that's the whole, to me, that's one of the differences between looking at what I might consider the new age, or the information that comes out of the secret, or, you know, the law of attraction. Uh-huh. You don't look at the results of your life. And of course, we're interested in those. We want to be healthy. We want to be wealthy. We want to be all those things. But in the course, the real result is your peace of mind.
Exactly.
It's not the curriculum. It's the peace of mind. And I think we don't get that so often, is that, you know, to get a PhD, you have to take some tough classes sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not the curriculum that we ought to be looking at. Those are not really our results. The results are, do we keep our peace of mind?
Right, right. Yeah, and that's huge. And somewhere in the course it says, you know, peace of mind is not a small gift.
Mm-mm.
But ego doesn't want to look at that. Ego says, oh, but there must be something that's going to actually make me happy.
Right.
You know, outside of myself. And then in that same paragraph that has that our favorite sixth paragraph, that favorite opening line there, it says, if you seek love outside yourself, you can be certain that you perceive hatred within and are afraid of it.
Mm.
So basically, it's again that setup. It's just a horrific, but meaningless and ultimately silly strategy that the ego has of trying to keep us forever chasing the carrot on the stick in the space-time dream drama to make sure that we're never really happy. You know? because that's why it's insane. The ego, as Ken Wapnick points out so brilliantly over and over again in so many ways, is, you know, the ego is 100% insane. Our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, is 100% sane, and 100% of the time we have the ability to choose between those two, and that's really the only valid choice, not choosing between illusions, as the previous paragraph points out.
Right.
So that's where we have this tremendous capacity, and the power of our mind is awesome, because we used it. What the metaphysics of this curriculum suggests is that we used the power of our mind out of fear to make up an entire universe, a cosmos. I mean, putting the Hollywood special effects houses to shame, but our special effect is the universe. I mean, down to the tiniest nanobot, micro nano, you know, the subatomic particles, and all the way out to galactic clusters and everything in between. We did a bang-up job, you know, a big bang, a tiny mad idea job of making up a cosmic joke that whose proportions we can't even fathom. And yet, what we really are is an essence that makes that entire realm nothing by comparison, because there is no comparison. And that's, again, the metaphysics. I think it's difficult to dwell on it because our mind rebels and has such resistance to it. But in our deeper, stiller moments of peace, when we think about the idea that as the course starts out, is, you know, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. The idea that perfect oneness has no opposite. And I think you alluded to that earlier in this conversation, that. The love that we're looking for has no opposite. So the quality that goes beyond separation in our mind is that very longing that gives us the opportunity to keep looking at the things that prevent us from being at peace, which is basically making idols and making special love and hate objects out of the specifics in our lives, and dragging the people and the circumstances into the battleground, rather than saying, no, I don't have to fight this. I don't have to fight myself. I can actually see this as either a call for love or an expression of love, no matter what it is in any given moment.
Oh, and I love that you brought that up, because that too is just an incredible, I mean, if we only understood that one thing, you know, how different would our lives be? That every single response, every single person is either asking for love or offering love, no matter what they're doing. It can always be divided into those two.
Exactly. And ego doesn't like to look at that, because then it basically says, oh, my victimhood strategy just got, you know,
blown out.
Here.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
pay no attention to that man behind the curtain there. You know?
Exactly.
Moving all the levers and turning the knobs and making, you know, the thunder and the lightning and the great and powerful monster that, you know, we tremble and knock our knees looking at, you know.
Yeah.
But that's just because we were such good movie makers.
Yeah. Well, and just like you said, I mean, if anybody ever doubts their intelligence or what they're capable of with their thoughts, just think about it. You created the world. Mm-hmm. You did. You created this movie. You created this incredible landscape. That's how intelligent you are. That's how powerful your thoughts are.
Exactly. And to clarify, it's not saying that the Bruce or the CA or, you know, the whatever person that we think we are as separate individuals did it, but collectively. And that's why A Course in Miracles addresses the mind as the totality. Because it's trying to remind us that that's what we are. That's what we never left. There is a totality that is the truth of what we are, and that's what it's trying to reach. And that's basically who this entire, and it's not really a who, it's the what, this entire course is pitched to. It's basically pitching not at the person sitting with a blue book reading a bunch of little characters in black on a white background. It's basically reaching beyond and between the words to that essence that we are, that never left perfect oneness, that is this completely inclusive mind that doesn't recognize any validity to separation or differences or better or worse than or any kind of comparative thing, because that's what we really are. So in order to make that stick, in order to transition gradually and comfortably to that awareness, we just need to look at the classroom of what we've made special, what we've made into our little idols of oh, this is going to make me happy, or this next you know, next movie or TV show or meal or you know, XYZ, you know, anything specific, but certainly our primary, you know, romantic and familial relationships are huge in that. They're the poster children of, yeah, of ego strategy to keep us mindless and to keep us forever blaming and, you know, fire up the blame thrower, everyone. That's someone did something to me again, you know.
That's right.
And how much of our media is flooded with that stuff. So the challenge is to be compassionate and recognize that, you know, everybody's fighting the hard battle, but no battle is worse than any other battle, because every illusion is the same. There's, and as long as we think that there's illusion A is not equal illusion B, we can pretty much bet we've bought into ego's idolatry again, and it's saying, oh, well, this, if I can just, you know, maneuver my way or manipulate my way over to this situation, then I'll be happy.
That's right. Well, and actually, I had that situation recently where I was really up in arms about something, and I was talking to a friend in, and we weren't even really, I mean, of course, we weren't talking about the Course in Miracles. We were talking about something else, but we're both students, and I don't remember his exact words, but he basically said to me, well, what makes you think your illusion is any more correct than theirs? And even though those weren't the exact words, I can tell you there was a major aha moment, because I did realize all those times in the course, either whether it's the text or the manual for teachers or wherever it is, it basically says you're insane. And I recognize I had all of a sudden elevated myself up and said, well, I'm not insane. All these other people are insane, you know. And so when my friend said that to me, I went, oh, yeah, I'm just as insane. My illusion just seems more credible than theirs.
Right, right. Or to paraphrase George Orwell, you know, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Well, that was exactly it. And so, I mean, I knew I didn't like how I was feeling, but I still was really cherishing my version of the truth as the real truth. And so when he put it in that perspective of, okay, so they're insane, but you're not, you know, it's like, oh my God, I've fallen into the trap once again.
Yeah. And it's so easy to do, but it's so important to forgive ourselves and not judge ourselves when we find ourselves becoming partial to a group or an identity or a nation or a culture or a sub, you know, subgroup of anything. And I think the word partial is kind of an interesting clue, because it implies favoritism, but it also implies incompletion.
Yes.
And when we're incomplete, we're basically saying there's something outside me that I lack. And what could be more you know, quintessential than the whole premise that our special love and special hate relationships are based on? Well, there's something that I'm going to use to keep me anchored in the world of dreams. And I don't care if it's something I like or something I hate, because it doesn't make any difference. It's the same sticky goo that's gluing me to an identity that doesn't have anything to do with reality.
Right. And that's exactly it. It's the same sticky glue, you know. It's the minute you're excluding, the minute that you're being partial. You know, and you know, and yet at the same time, one thing I always appreciated about Ken, and I don't know if I read this or if I heard it in a workshop, is that, you know, we then kind of can take that information and say, okay, then I've got to love everybody. And even if I don't want that person coming to my party, I've got to invite them and, you know, that kind of thing. And he goes, no, it's okay to have preferences.
Exactly.
It's okay to have preferences, just like you like chocolate ice cream over vanilla ice cream, but you've got to also recognize that you've got your preferences.
Right.
You know, just look at it. Just look at it.
That's exactly, and that's how this section starts out. Just, you know, be not afraid to look. And every time we're willing to look without judging ourselves, without condemning ourselves, and just say, oh yeah, I have this preference. And then notice when the preference becomes a must have or must not have. And that's you know, we get those clues all the time. And like, I think that's what you bring up is really important, because we're going to have preferences. We're going to say, I'm going to do this first in my list of things to do today, because I prefer to get this done first, and you know, X, Y, and Z, and yada yada yada, and we can go on countless examples of that. But it's only when we can look at those things and say, and kind of like if we can append the phrase, and it's not a big deal, to anything that we say.
Yeah.
You know, that's when we're making some strides in recognizing that the ego strategy is to always make it, if not a little deal, a big deal. And but the little deals and the big deals are really no different. You know, there's no order of difficulty in miracles, as our book says.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you said that, because truthfully, you know that phrase, it's all good. I don't like that phrase at all. And the reason I don't, though, is it feels to me like when somebody says it is when you know it's not all good.
Right, right.
You know, it's like that's my clue that, okay, this isn't all good. And so it's like, and, you know, some of it even stinks. But but I think maybe I could go with, and it's no big deal. That I could probably go with.
Yeah. And actually on the route, on route to that, is looking at the big deals, and which really, you know, I think points up the importance of what you just said, is because that isn't how we think, we need to look at when it is a big deal and when we've made when our preferences have had feature creep, if you will, and become must-haves and must-not-haves, when we allow anything to upset us, if we can just look at it, and we don't have to necessarily change how we're behaving, although ultimately it probably does change what we behave, but that's not the point. The idea is to look at our minds, to bring our attention back to the mind and say, oh, when am I allowing my peace to be compromised by a circumstance or a situation or a condition?
Right.
And relationships of the humankind are certainly, as since we've identified ourselves as humans, most of us, mm-hmm. I don't know how many animals or minerals or vegetables are listening to this right now, but I'm presuming most of your audience is human. So since we've self-identified as humans, and then that's pretty much our primary classroom. You know, we get to make that a major opportunity to forgive ourselves when we catch ourselves getting upset about stuff.
Yeah. Right. Well, and I want to read something else from one of the paragraphs in this lesson. It says, or not lesson, I guess the textbook. Uh-huh. If special relationships of any kind would hinder God's completion, can they have any value to you? What would interfere with God must interfere with you. And I love that, mm-hmm. you know, because I mean, ultimately, it's like, okay, if God doesn't even think they're important enough to, you know, they're a distraction, they're a hindrance, what can they really be of you? You know, what value can you really put on them?
Mm-hmm. And obviously the ego's answer is, well, I get all kinds of mileage from that. But yeah. It doesn't want to admit that. Because, you know, any time we can dive, for example, into victimhood, martyrdom, self-pity, you know, oh, woe is me, you know, playing the little violin on the shoulder. I just sometimes used to remember, visualize a little tiny violin I'm playing on the shoulder. Little,
yes.
A little me. You know? And then, but whenever we catch ourselves doing that and say, oh, I'm choosing this identification, this experience to compromise my peace. I'm intentionally, consciously choosing as a value this particular interpretation, which is all it is, mm-hmm. to become an idol, to become more important to me than the reality that we have in truth with each other as one essence.
Yep. It's right? Powerful stuff. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just hanging on your words, Bruce.
Okay.
Letting them sink in.
Well, I think that helps if we can kind of get ourselves out of the way too. If we can let what we are flow through us rather than the who we are, which is the ego's default. You know, that I think can be a really helpful way to remember that shared interests are a primary mechanism for undoing the specialness, the special love, the special hate, and seeing where we've made external things important mm-hmm. by seeing the things that transcend the boundaries, that knock down the metaphoric walls between individuals. And if we, you know, like Ken Wapner says, if we make it about the other person, that's really a great place to start, because it reminds us that we can look at, well, what does this other person in my life, whoever we happen to be relating to, what is their objective, not on a mundane level, but what are they really wanting to experience inwardly? And it recognizes the same thing that I want to experience, same thing everybody wants to experience. And that essence of shared interest, I think, is really a hugely helpful tool for knocking down the idols and dismantling their you know, their demolition capabilities.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and one other thing, you know, to make sure that we're being encouraging enough, I guess I would say, is because I think this too, there's many, many chapters, there's many lessons in the text and in the workbook where it's sort of like, I feel like they take us through this route. And some of the route can be kind of scary. You know, it's almost like you're on this path in the forest and there's the mountain lion, there's the bear, there's whatever. But you always come out into the light, as it even said in the beginning, coming out into the sunlight. And so because I think we can kind of look at it. I know I do sometimes go, oh my God, this is going to take me forever. I just, this is so daunting. And you keep saying, start with the little stuff. But even at the very end of this chapter, it's like, you know, waken from time. And on this side of the bridge to timelessness, you understand nothing. But as you step lightly across it, upheld by timelessness, or time, yeah, timelessness, you are directed straight to the heart of God. Uh-huh. And I mean, just, I guess the visual I get on that is it doesn't take much. It's what the Course often says, the little willingness.
Exactly.
Just take one step. And the minute you even take one step, the illusion starts to fall away.
Right, right. And each moment when we choose against the ego strategy of making big deals out of things and making specifics, the things that in our mind are the cause of our peace of mind or lack thereof. Every time we do that, we not only strengthen the thought system that takes us away from the illusion, but we have in that moment, what the Course calls a holy instant, we have the experience of peace. And then that builds. It's a cumulative thing to where that over time we realize, gee, that strategy that I was using before really didn't work too well. Mm-hmm. And this one that, you know, the Course says, try it, even if you don't like it, you know, just see if it works for you. When you actually do try it, it actually does work. And you are, for those moments, when you're choosing against ego, you're choosing for the truth that we all are. And that's a pretty peaceful thing. And it's not a small gift.
Right. Yeah. And you know what you said, strengthening what you want to have in your life. You didn't put it exactly that way. But I think sometimes we forget the power of that. Mm-hmm. If you don't feed a plant, it dies.
Right.
And by simply removing our attention from something, it has no choice but to get smaller and eventually just kind of wilt away.
Exactly.
And we can put our energy and our resources and our thoughts into what's working for us. And if we don't feed those other things, eventually they don't have a choice.
Right.
They got to go away.
Right. Yeah, it's a gradual transition. I like to think of if you, you know, look at a chart where you have something ramping down, another thing ramping up over time. If you can imagine, you know, a chart mm-hmm. on a time graph. I think that's sort of what we do. I mean, obviously, it would be difficult to try to, you know, show that mathematically, but overall, as kind of a symbol, that's what we're doing. We're fading down the volume on the ego's director's cut on our DVD, and fading up the Holy Spirit's or our inner kindness teacher's interpretation, which almost always is just a gentle smile that doesn't even need words. It's just basically saying, oh yeah. This specific, hey, Bruce, you don't have to let that bug you.
Yeah, and what a great analogy. See, once again, that's a great analogy of the picture doesn't change. Mm-hmm. Here is the curriculum, here's the picture. But are you going to listen to the director's cut that's the ego, mm-hmm. or are you going to listen to the director's cut or, you know, the producer's cut, whatever you want to call it, that is your higher self or God or Jesus or the kindness inner teacher? Mm-hmm. What a great way to look at it, that you're looking at the same thing, but whose interpretation are you going to listen to?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Great. That's a great place to leave this, I think, today, Bruce.
Well, thank you again for having me on your program.
But speaking of which, do you have anything you want to announce, or are there any other wrap up comments you want to make?
Well, as always, I think it's always helpful if people avail themselves of the wonderful resources that the Foundation for A Course in Miracles has, facim.org. I've been going through there's over, I think, 1,300 something like that, Q&A and questions on there. I'm about 300 something now, and they're all gems. But there's a tremendous wealth of great information and resources for students of A Course in Miracles, including the back issues of the Lighthouse magazine and tons of other articles and resources. I've also got a little blog that's acimblog.com, and which references those and for people who want to contribute to. Articles and things like that. I'm happy to entertain those things. And I also post things on Facebook and the ACIM blog group there and Twitter and that kind of stuff. And it's a lot of fun with it. So anyway, yeah, lots of resources out there. But certainly, you know, I would recommend starting with the facim.org website for particularly for people that are new and want to kind of go straight to this tremendous legacy that Ken Wapnick and the people there have done and continue to do, including video broadcasts of their new programs.
Well, and also you can find Ken and similar things from the foundation on YouTube.
That's right.
I knew that was there, but I hadn't really discovered any of them. I really hadn't spent any time, and it's fun. It's nice going to YouTube. But like you, I go to that online bookstore at the foundation quite a bit, and I've got lots and lots of CDs and books, etc. So that's just like a treasure house of information at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. So I'll make sure that's posted in the chat room. And also, if you go over to my Facebook page, which is C.A. Brooks, you will also find links not only to the online bookstore, but also to Bruce Rawls' pages as well. So, Bruce, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you, CA.
And I also want to thank all the listeners and those of you in the chat room. And I also want to thank our producer, Scott Weaver. And remember that you can always find me on 12listen.com. And you can also find me on Tuesdays on my other show, Simple Tales, where we are discussing astrology. But for today, you have about 5 minutes to get yourself another cup of coffee or tea, or to get a sandwich or whatever, depending on what time of day you're listening. And because Throughline with Christine DeMaurier is coming up next on Fabulous Fridays on 12 Radio. Until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, here on 12 Radio, where we are changing the way we think about life and spirituality.